From ThatShelf.com, this is Black Hole Films.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
What's a black hole film, you ask? Well, you know those films you always meant to get around to watching, but you never did for whatever reason? Well, that's what they are. And this podcast is all about embracing them and checking those films off our lists and talking about them and whatever else happens to come up. I'm Canadian filmmaker Jeremy Lalonde, and I will be your host. You can follow me on Twitter at LalondeJeremy or check out my website, jeremylalonde.com, for more information on me and my projects. If you like the show, please subscribe to it, rate, review it, and leave a comment on whatever platform it is you're listening. It really does make a difference in helping to get more ears tuning in. And if you like this show, check out the others on the ThatShelf.com family of podcasts. And without further delay, let's get into this week's film. This is episode 151, and today I'm sitting down with Noah Taylor. Noah is like a jack of all trades. He's a journalist, a film reviewer, but also an amazing EPK filmmaker. He does great behind the scenes. He did the one that's on the How to Plan an Orgy in a Small Town Blu-ray, if you happen to have it. If not, you can pick it up. And we're going to sit down and watch a film together. All right, so we're sitting down to watch Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I'm Jeremy. I have seen this film, but not for quite a while.
I have never seen it, but I've seen parts on TV, and I've seen the remake, and I've read the book. So I'm looking to see where I'm surprised.
And this is Noah Taylor, although I will have given you an intro.
Okay.
So sorry, give me that again.
I've seen the remake many times. I'm actually a fan of the remake. We can talk about that later. I've read the book and I've seen parts on TV, so I feel like I've seen it. So I'm looking to see where I'm surprised.
You're virgin enough.
Yeah.
You've been to third base, but you're,
that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for is there anything that's going to surprise me here? Cause I feel like I've seen it, but I've definitely never watched it all the way through.
Oh, it's fascinating. So it's like, you know the story then.
Of course. Yeah.
But what's interesting, because Roald Dahl is on record for not liking the adaptation of this. This adaptation anyway.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know that.
But that being said, mm-hmm. I think some people have said that the Burton adaptation is more faithful to the book. So it'll be interesting for you to hear you come at it from that.
Yeah.
Because I think I, like most people of our generation, I saw this as a kid. And so, when the Burton version came out, I was very familiar with, and in particular, I think, people think about this movie and they think about Gene Wilder's performance in it because it's pretty iconic.
Yeah.
And there's a couple sequences in this where it was like when the movie was coming, the new one was coming out, I was like, well, what are they going to do with this moment? Because there's a couple of big pieces that you kind of wonder about.
Mm-hmm.
I almost want to ask you what scenes you've seen. I guess I might as well, it doesn't matter.
Sure. I know the music. I know most of the big songs.
Okay.
And there's one scene. So actually, I'll say I read the book only a couple months ago when we talked about doing this, so that would be fresh in my mind.
Yeah.
So I do know at least what the differences are between the adaptation of the Burton and the book. One scene I know is in this that's not in the book is when he starts acting all mean to the kids. I know about that part. And that's not in the book. And then... Yeah, I know some of the mostly the music and the Oompa Loompas and the plot, obviously.
Yeah,
yeah.
Here's a question: so you've read the book? Have you read Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator?
No, I haven't.
Okay,
no.
It's bonkers as shit.
Yeah,
yeah. It's really really weird. And also, I bought this box set for the kids, this Roald Dahl box set, and we went through the whole thing. And there's this extra thing that's added to it that talks about aborted projects.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about he had a third story planned for it was going to be a trilogy at one point, but how they describe what was going to happen in that is mm-hmm. it involved the president of the United States, and it was just bonkers. It had nothing to do with the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
It was so far removed from the original concept that it was like, what are you, why not just make this an original story?
So I didn't know he did sequels to anything. I forgot that he had done The Glass Elevator. We can talk about it after. You can maybe tell me what happens in that, maybe after we've watched the movie.
I'm trying to remember because it's I can give you the setup for it.
Yeah.
But it's a bonkers kind of thing that it might be worth checking out because it's not, I'm sure it's the kind of thing that if you really wanted to, you could read it on, in an app, like on a weekend afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty fast reads for sure.
Yeah, but it's a bonkers piece of literature. Mm-hmm. But all the more surprising because this one, I read this to my kids like not that long ago, within the last couple of years. And it's like, you know, it's a pretty cohesive piece of literature.
Yeah.
It's got a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah. And actually, and I've made note when I was reading it, I can tell, obviously, the things, like, why they added what they added to make it a feature-length movie. It's pretty clear, like... why they made the changes they made, because they to stretch it out into at least an hour and a half thing.
Have you read other doll stuff?
Witches, when I was a kid, was always one of my favorites. The Twits, again, when I was a kid. So I haven't read any of them in recent years, but...
they hold those, up, man. Those are the two They're big great. Ones. We went through the whole thing. And I gotta say, what I really love about him is... I mean, part of it's the Britishness, and that's, and Canadians enjoy that too.
Yeah.
But the dude's dark. Like, he writes for kids, but he doesn't give a shit. Like, he's okay... putting stuff in there that is questionable.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I noted is particularly dark when I was reading this book was before Charlie gets the golden ticket, when his family is literally starving, and they're like, Charlie had to start leaving earlier for school just because he knew he had to like save his energy because he's starving. He's got to like leave earlier for school. He's like, I got to take my time, man. I'm like, whoa.
He's starving himself to death.
Yeah, he's just like, they're literally starving. He's got to leave earlier for school because he doesn't have the strength to, you know, walk fast enough.
Yeah, they're just eating broth.
Yeah.
Hilarious. All right. Well, then, without that, without anything, I guess we should just dive into it.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, great.
Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Okay, so we just finished.
Yeah.
And?
I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, honestly, I felt like everything after they got to the factory felt like I'd kind of seen it, even though a lot of it I hadn't. But yeah, my biggest surprise was how funny all the stuff before the factory was.
There's a bunch of weird interstitials that I remembered as soon as they started, but I kind of had forgotten about.
It's like almost like Woody Allen jokes or something in there. Like the, like that's really deadpan. The newscaster is like, you know, there's more important things in the world, but, I can't really think of what they are right now.
The tone of this movie is fantastic. I really appreciate the dark, really just dry wit this movie has, and especially and it almost makes me wonder. It's like if they didn't shoot all that stuff at the end, almost to set up the way Gene Wilder does Wonka. Mm-hmm. Where like, I love all just the stuff whenever the kids are in danger and he's just so deadpan.
Yeah.
But please stop, come back, don't.
Yeah, that was funny. But here's like maybe a controversial take. And like, I think Gene Wilder was great in it, but I don't think he was the funniest part of the movie.
Yeah.
Like I didn't find his parts as laugh out loud as, like I said, those parts like the therapist doing the analyst who's like, no, but tell me where. Like how obsessed all the adults are about finding the golden ticket. All these little, like you said, the little interstitials.
I don't even find him hilarious so much as I find Gene Wilder just so, it's just such an interesting take.
Yeah.
And way to do it. Like it's way less, it's eccentric in a different way than Johnny Depp does it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, no, it's a great performance. But yeah, it's like, I don't see it as like the comedic center of the movie necessarily. Yeah. He's more like the edgier kind of like, is this kind of, you know, is he actually killed them all? And that's actually one thing that this version lacks that the other ones have is that Charlie sees the kids all coming out of the factory in both the other versions. They're all a little blue or stretched out.
Yeah.
But you know, at least you know they're alive.
He tells him at the end that it'll all be fine.
Yeah, but he says a lot of things.
It's true. Well, what's interesting about that, to that point, is that when Gene Wilder got offered the part in the movie, first of all, apparently he, after his audition, Meryl Streep, the director, ran down the hallway and grabbed him. He says, it's yours. Like, the part's yours if you want. And the producer was furious because he's like, I got to negotiate a goddamn fee with this man. You're just offering the part?
Yeah.
But Wilder said that he would do the movie on one condition, was that he got to do the intro that he did there where he walks out with a cane and then launches into a somersault. That was his idea.
Okay.
And the reason why he wanted to do that is because he wanted the audience to never know if he was telling the truth or lying.
Okay. And I think I've heard that story before.
Yeah. And that idea bled itself into everything. Like, there's they kind of like, just when they first come in and they're going in that room, and it's like, oh, we go back out this way. It's like, that was the entrance. It's like, was it?
Yeah.
And then even going into that hallway that is forced perspective and gets smaller, like,
yeah,
it's all those ideas were birthed out of the introduction that Gene Wilder came up for himself.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. He's just basically fucking with them all the time.
Yeah, but it's great because that's kind of the ending, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you flagged that moment when we were watching it, the fizzy lifting drink room.
Yeah, because that's only in this version as well. I knew that from Family Guy. I think Family Guy spoofed it. Again, yeah, the other reason why I felt, I think I forgot to mention that I've seen this movie is because of the countless spoofs. It's been spoofed so many and parodied. And so, yeah, I'd never seen that scene for real before, but I'd seen it in Family Guy and some other spoofs. But yeah, when it happened, I was like, wait a second, like, this just makes them just as bad as the rest of them, even though it's Grandpa Joe's idea. But yeah,
Charlie puts up no rebuke.
No, it's true. He's like, yeah. Like, and then, yeah, it's like, well, they should be gone too right after that. And yeah, he almost costs Charlie the factory.
He redeems himself.
Yeah, because he has the gobstopper. And again, that's a plot line that's only in this version as well. The whole Slugsworth gobstopper ruse, that's not in any of the other versions.
What happens in the book again? Is it just that he survives?
Yeah, and it's the he doesn't go against his word, and then I can't remember the whole family thing. I think in the book too, he doesn't want him to bring his family. There might have been it's a brief conflict there, but kind of, it's all wrapped up very quickly. Like,
this has a very abrupt ending too.
Yeah. Whereas, like, the Burton version, for example, the ending's much more drawn out with, like, oh, no, you can't bring your family. And then they kind of go their separate ways. And then Wonka comes back and kind of has a change of heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little more drawn out.
Well, I think that's actually the test.
Yeah.
Because the whole, the Burton version is really about, like, they bring in the relationship with Wonka and his father and how they're estranged.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't want Charlie to be with his family because he doesn't want Charlie to have a family when he didn't have one. He's miserable. But it's almost like a test. Like, that's the test that he does for him, because then in the end, it's him choosing his family over Wonka that makes him want to give the factory to him.
But I don't think that was his ultimate plan. I think he, like, goes home and thinks about it. Yeah, yeah. And then Wonka kind of realizes,
they give him an arc.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Where he doesn't really have one.
Which a lot of people, I think, I gather, didn't like that about it. So, yeah, to get back to that, I think the reason that when the Burton one came out and I saw it and I really liked it, and everyone's like, oh, no, like, you know, that's not my Willy Wonka. I love it.
Yeah.
And that's why I always came back to, well, I've actually never seen this one, so I didn't have a relationship with it. And so the Burton one was fine to me. I mean, it's not perfect. There's a lot of flaws in it, but overall, there's a lot of things I really like about it. And yeah. But yeah, they're very different. And that's why I like...
They're very different. Yeah. And that's why it's great, because it's like, if you're going to redo it, you better do something different.
Yeah. This one is more of a musical. And that's the other thing that kind of surprised me. Well, it didn't surprise me, but it was definitely a bunch of songs in there that I did not know about, or I didn't realize. Candyman, I didn't realize was from this. I think you mentioned it was in Simpsons. And
I'm not 100% sure if Candyman's an original song for this, because I know they tell. Because I know I have like an old organ book from when I was a kid that has the Candyman in it, and the lyrics are slightly different.
Okay.
So, because there's that line that goes, "The Candyman bakes everything he makes."
Yeah.
But in the... Well, actually, that's how their song goes. But in the movie, the shop owner sings, "Willy Wonka bakes everything he makes."
Oh, okay.
Or makes everything he bakes, whatever the order is. Mm. And so he's changed. That's different. So I wonder if they didn't appropriate that song for the movie.
Right. Which is a similar thing. I don't think we looked it up yet, but we don't know if gobstoppers came from this movie. Everlasting Gobstoppers, what was first?
I'll look it up while we discuss, because that's a good question. Because that is definitely, I mean, they don't look like that, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
They look almost like a Jax, like a colored...
Yeah, that would be too hard to manufacture, I think.
Yeah, then the ball. Well, that's what Charlie brings to the table. Charlie's like, you know, Wonka, we got to do things in the circles.
Yeah. But yeah, the other thing that, I mean, again, I wasn't surprised but didn't really realize is that, yeah, it's almost half the movie until they get to the factory. It's drawn out by everyone looking for the tickets, but the other thing it's drawn out by is there's way more songs. And yeah, like I think you said, you'd even forgotten about the song Charlie's mom sings. And I think a mutual friend of ours posted a thing on Facebook a couple days ago about a parody of the song in the musicals that no one likes. Did you see that?
Yeah. And I'm like, those are the songs I actually like.
I turned it off after because there is that song, and I think this is that song in that movie. But yeah, in the parody, they mentioned Cellophane, Mr. Cellophane. I'm like, I like Mr. Cellophane.
Same here. I'm like, I can get some other ones in that range, but I'm like, yeah. Mr. Cellophane is a fantastic.
And I actually didn't listen to the rest of the parody after they dropped
Yeah, same here. I turned it off. I was like, fuck you. Yeah. Shit on.
But it's true, though. Like in most musicals, especially ones like this where there's like half a dozen songs, usually like two, maybe three are good.
I got it here. Mm-hmm. The Everlasting Gobstoppers, from their Nestle's Willy Wonka Candy Company brand, were first introduced in 1976 by Breaker Confections and are named after the Everlasting Gobstoppers in Roald Dahl's children's book.
Yeah, this was... Yeah. That makes sense.
So I feel, well, 76, is that this when is the movie came out?
This is 71, I think.
So it was a couple of years. So yeah. I was like, it would have been a great marketing thing to...
At the same time.
To bring them out at the same time. But
yeah.
What was the... I'm wondering what the other... the Willy Wonka Candy Factory. What the other candies were that came out under that brand. I feel like there were Wonka bars at some point.
Yeah. Like, I think... That the Gobstopper was kind of their mainstay because they had different kinds of Gobstoppers, but that's what it makes me think of when you think of Willy Wonka candies that you can actually buy in the store.
64, the 64 novel. Mm-hmm. The Wonka bar is both a fictional bar and a staple food inspired by the varieties of Wonka bars are subsequently manufactured and sold in the real world, formerly by the Willy Wonka Candy Company, a division of Nestle. Bars are discontinued in 2010 due to poor sales. Well, that's just sad. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No. I was looking at my notes now, too, because I made a few notes.
There's some weird... There's just some like little weird things. I love that moment where the mother says something, there's 100 billion people in this world. It's like, oof.
I think it's just
she's not well educated.
Yeah, maybe that's it. She's just not well educated.
It's kind of a fantastic movie. She's kind of hand waved the fact that Grandpa Joe has apparently been bedridden for 20 years, but can all of a sudden.
Well, yeah, at least in this version, like he's got a bit of a song where he's kind of getting his legs back a little bit.
Yeah, whereas
in the Burton one, I think he gets right out of bed and dances a jig. Like
that's almost better.
Yeah. So I think it's almost like fuck you to everyone else a little bit.
Yeah.
But
it's like, wait a minute, you could have worked this whole time.
You're
surprisingly spry, old
very
man.
Very able-bodied.
Apparently, the guy that played Grandpa Joe was actually like 90% blind.
Oh, really?
And they had to use like a red light. So that he knew where to look, because that's the only thing he could see. And the shoes under the bed are his. He put them there and wouldn't let them move them because he didn't. It was like the most his prized possession.
Oh, really?
And was worried someone would they disappear from set.
I forgot what I was going to say.
Do you know what the Chocolate River is made of?
Well, water and food coloring, I would assume, or...
It's made of water and chocolate and cream.
Oh, really?
And by a weekend of shooting, it smelt rancid because the cream went bad.
I was wondering about that. That little kid had to get in there and...
By that point, they shot him and them getting in.
Yeah, yeah.
But they actually used real chocolate.
Oh, well, that's... Because it's too bad because it doesn't look like real chocolate.
No, it's too thin.
Yeah, it's way watered down.
I think the Burton version is creamier. It's definitely
well, thicker. It's a CGI enhanced too. I think.
Yeah, I'm sure.
One thing I do think the Burton version got better and really nailed was all of the stuff at Charlie's house. I think is much sweeter and like having Noah Taylor and Helena Bonham Carter and seeing it from the outside, that kind of like crooked shack that they lived in.
I couldn't remember in this version, his father's dead.
I guess there's no father in this one.
No, they mention at one point, it's like, well, if his father was alive, it's just a throwaway line.
Yeah. He's definitely, he has a father in the book. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I remember that because I remember the toothpaste stuff, like the toothpaste caps, he made stalls at him or something like that, right?
Yeah. I also wonder too, because you said that Roald Dahl, wasn't a fan of this, and I wonder if it was because of, it's kind of been Americanized by having, like, Willy Wonka and Charlie, both Americans. I wonder if he wanted Brits in there. Because I feel like they were in London or in England. Like, his teacher was British.
It was shot like, in Russia, I think, or Germany. It was shot in, like, one of those countries. But it's, like, clearly... Well, it's almost a mishmash. They don't say where Wonka's factory takes place.
Yeah.
And they almost... And he avoided... There's also no vehicles in the movie.
Okay.
Because he wanted it to not be dated.
Okay.
The director.
Hmm.
But, yeah, it doesn't really tell you where Charlie lives. But he's clearly American.
Yeah, Charlie's American. His family is his teacher is British. Who I recognize that actor as well.
He's
pretty funny. He looks like a British character actor who probably got a lot of work around then. But yeah, so I wonder if that was I don't know if that was an issue with Roald Dahl, because I'm sure he imagined them all being British.
I don't know if it was that. I think I don't know what his real issue was. Mm-hmm. The thing that always drives me nuts. Is the first chocolate bar they buy him for his birthday is the wrong fucking chocolate bar.
Yeah, fools. He had one job.
Yeah, there's no point.
Yeah.
I remember in the book, I love the bit in the book where they go into the detail about how he gets one bar every year. That's his birthday present.
Yeah.
And he slowly eats it. And it makes it last.
And shares it with them all, too. He shares it, yeah. And, yeah, they did that in the Burton one as well. It kind of drove that point home a little bit. And the other thing that was in the book, too, that I kind of made note of, and it's like, oh, well, it makes sense that this isn't in either of the movies, is that after Mike TV dies or, you know, gets kicked off the tour or gets shrunk.
This really is like a horror film.
Yeah, yeah. It could be made that way for sure. But the song the Oompa Loompas sing after that is all about how TV's terrible for your brains and like how, you know, everyone should read more. And it's like, oh, it makes sense that they would change that for the movies. Like,
yeah,
it's like basically saying, you know, everyone's just got to read more.
Yeah, they make it fit for the medium they're in.
Yeah. The other thing they did in the book was every kid got two parents or two guests to bring with them. So they all bought both their parents. It's like, well, yeah, I guess it makes sense that they would, like, cut that in half for the movies. We don't really need 10 adults following them around the whole time. It's a bit overkill. But, yeah.
That way you just have one of each.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been a bit too much.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of other stuff I was trying to think of while I was watching this. There's a bunch of little weird little kind of trivia bits. Mm. The when they shot the riverboat the fucked up trippy scene.
Yeah.
The kids and the adults didn't know how Gene Wilder was going to do it.
Okay.
And they actually thought he was losing his mind.
Well, were they actually projecting everything practical?
It's like a chicken head with his head being cut off.
Yeah, that was messed up. I knew that scene existed, but I'd never seen it in its entirety.
I still don't understand the purpose of that.
No. Just for people who were there on like acid trips in the theater in 1971, I don't know.
Yeah, it fits.
Yeah. I looked up the director's filmography, and I didn't recognize any other titles that he'd done it. And I was expecting to see some, like, something that would at least go along with this sort of like psychedelic imagery they put into this, but it all looked a little
tame.
From just judging by the titles. I mean, I could be wrong.
Yeah. What were some of his other films? I was going to look it up.
I didn't recognize any of them, to be honest.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Peter Ustov, I think, or Ustov or something, the actor who plays Charlie, this is his only movie.
Mm-hmm.
He was offered like a 5-picture deal and he didn't want to do it.
Oh. One and done.
One and done. He became a veterinarian.
He became another kind of good doctor. Freddie Highmore in the Burton one.
Hilarious. That's true. And then, when Gene Wilder died, on his Twitter feed, he changed his like bio to like father veterinarian inheritor chocolate factory on August 24th, 2016. Whatever the date is that.
That
he passed.
Was Wilder part of the 2016 club? It's a lot of them kind of like got overshadowed by other people that year.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. Well, I remember his name coming up at the Oscars.
Yeah.
Was he one of the ones that died really close to it? I don't know. He was always.
It always makes me think of
that one made me sad.
The Mr. Show joke, though. I think it was early 2000s, and it was like a Mr. Show special where they're dubbing over these old news anchors, and they're like, Gene Wilder's ghost has begun to prematurely haunt a family. Seriously, when is this guy going to die? He's been alive for fucking ever.
Aww. Poor Gene Wilder. He didn't mind Johnny Depp's performance in the remake, but he didn't like the movie.
Oh, really?
He doesn't like, apparently he's not a fan of Tim Burton's work.
Yeah, well, that was a weird kind of crux for Tim Burton, where, like, at that point, he was losing a lot of people. I was still kind of on the Burton train, and I really, like, I thought that was a really good year for him, because that came out the same year as Corpse Bride, and I'm like, guys, Burton's still good. But then after Alice in Wonderland and everything that's come since, I've,
well, then he just kind of became like a Disney filmmaker, or just like doing.
Yeah, well, him and Depp sold out together. yeah, they both like have gone way down in my estimation. I was like, again, like an apologist for several years when everyone else was kind of turning their backs. And I'm like, no, like Charlie and Chocolate Factory is still good. There's some hilarious parts. I love in that one when. Wonka's entrance is made after there's that little like weird doll show and they all catch on fire, and then like later on there's a good throwback to it when they're doing a tour of the factory and he's like, oh, this is the burn ward, that one's relatively new, and you see all the dolls like getting like fixed up. Yeah, so it's got like a lot of really good moments like that, and I liked his performance, but yeah, there was a little too much CGI. The songs were bad in that one.
Yeah. Well, these ones are so iconic. I think even if you don't know this movie, you've heard that Oompa Loompa song.
The Oompa Loompa song and Pure Imagination are both great. Yeah.
But at the same time, you can't just... You either have to do those songs like they were, or you have to just do something completely different. And at least they tried something completely different in the new one. I think they stuck a little closer to the original lyrics, with the exception of the Mike TV one.
I don't know, because, yeah, when I read the book, I hadn't seen this one, really, so I didn't really recognize the lyrics. But you know how it is when you, like, come to a song in a book? You kind of just, like, skim it. You know, you're like, yeah, all right, here's the song. But
I always use those sections to try to get my kids to fall asleep.
Oh, yeah, and try to, like, come up with what the tune would be?
Yeah. Well, it was easy for this because the tune existed, right?
True, yeah.
Reading Lord of the Rings was... that's a bitch to read those songs in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of when I... Like, Lord of the Rings is like... I would just kind of like skim that, I guess. Like, I got the gist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we need a 4-page song about...
They're long, yeah.
Yeah.
Those Oompa Loompas, man. I like the little animated words in those videos, too, when the Oompa Loompas sing.
Doesn't make any sense. They keep on mixing the chocolate after the kid contaminated it. They just wasted a bunch of cream.
That's true. Yeah, actually, you know what part was hilarious with the Oompa Loompas is when he gives the Mike TV the in the mom's purse, and the Oompa Loompa whispers something to Wonka. He's like, "Oh no, don't worry, you won't be held accountable." The Oompa's like, "Am I going to get shit for this? If I stretch out this kid and kill him?"
He's like, "No, I'll hold you responsible."
Yeah, don't worry.
Just so casual. It's like, yeah. Fuck, this is a great throwaway.
Yeah.
Hey, don't worry about it.
Yeah. The other thing that this one doesn't go into that the book and the movie do is a little bit of the Oompa Loompa's backstory, which is that they do basically like worship the cocoa bean.
Yeah, they don't talk about that at all. Yeah. He tells a story about how they lived in a terrible country.
Yeah, yeah, and he's basically rescued them. But yeah, the joke that I've seen online a bunch recently is like, oh yeah, Charlie, you inherited the factory, so yeah, now you're responsible for all these like dead kids, and oh, you got slaves as well? Like, he's kind of inheriting a bit of a... legal liabilities might have some issues to deal with after this.
It's true.
Yeah.
They don't have any of the flashback stuff that the Burton version shows.
Yeah. Well, the backstory with Willy Wonka's dad, that was all added into the Burton version.
Yeah.
And I can understand why a lot of people weren't really that into that. It's kind of like, we didn't ask for Willy Wonka's origin story.
Well, they're trying to give him an arc, and they were trying to use the fact that Charlie had a family and he didn't. And so it was almost like he was trying to create a family by getting a kid to come live with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a bit creepy too.
Well, yeah, I feel like that version leans really more into like the whole Michael Jackson vibe. Depp was maybe like channeling a little bit of like Michael Jackson Neverland.
I think channeling being fair. I think he was like co-opting it pretty outright.
Yeah. But
he was definitely drawing inspiration from like, you know, the Michael Jackson tropes that we know.
Yeah.
And from this movie, we get like one of the most famous internet tropes, which is that like that look of Gene Wilder that everyone uses.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, so tell me more about this.
Yeah. Oh, but that's not really the context of the scene at all.
No, no.
It's just like really good expression that lends itself well to that. Yeah. And then I was like, oh yeah, everyone's a famous image. I was watching Futurama like the other day, and I was like, oh, there's that meme of Fry, you know, doing squinting. Like, I'm not sure if this is something, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, these images that become like ingrained in our mind because of memes. It's like, oh, there's that.
Yeah, this one's one of the more famous ones that, that pops up. Every time it pops up, I'm delighted.
Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I think I've said like most of what I had, like most of my thoughts that occurred to me.
I really enjoyed it. Like this movie always struck me as having like a ridiculously abrupt ending.
Yeah.
And I loved, as a kid, it kind of threw me, and it works really well. And apparently when they shot it, they didn't let anyone know. Although Gene Wilder wanted to tell Charlie, the actor that played Charlie Peter, that he was going to yell at the end in the scene and yell at him. And the director refused to let him know. He's like, I want you to, like, don't do it. And then the shot breaks away at one point, and it continues over, watches him. His grandpa's like, we're going to fuck him over with a gobstopper, and then he walks back.
Yeah.
And there's tears in his eyes, and those are real.
Oh, yeah?
Like, that was the first take, because a kid was not... They had become friends at that point.
Yeah.
And so Gene wanted to give him a heads up. He's like, by the way, I'm going to yell here. Don't worry about it. I still love you.
Oh, okay.
But he's like, nope, don't give him a heads up, please. Just do it.
Gene Wilder was really good in that scene. That was a good performance in that scene. But why do you think everything in his office was half... It was cut in half.
I don't think there's a rhyme or reason for any of it. Yeah. I think it's just random. Apparently, there's a story, too, where the production designer came in to, like, do that. Like, one of the props guys came in to do last-minute things. And someone had, like a real coffee pot in there. Mm-hmm. And they assumed it was a prop coffee pot and cut it in half. And then the coffee spilled everywhere because it wasn't done up fake.
I thought you were going to say the prop guy got there and found out they'd cut the budget in half.
<Ba-dum-bum>. No, it's just, like, another thing that just shows he's eccentric, I think.
Yeah, yeah. They're like, what else can we do? Like, yeah.
Yeah. One other fun fact I just remembered. In the chocolate room, when he's singing the song and he sits down and he picks up the teacup, or the buttercup or whatever it is, and he drinks from it and then he takes a bite out of it.
Yeah.
So apparently a lot of the stuff in the chocolate room was edible. Well, I think they were supposed to know what.
Yeah.
And the teacups were edible, not that one.
Okay,
That's wax.
That's what I was wondering when I was watching it. I was like, what is that? That looks like wax.
He bit into wax, and then as soon as they called cutting, like, fly, and just spit it out. He bit into the wrong one, but they liked that performance the most.
Yeah. But yeah, back to the abrupt ending. You said, it ends with him sort of giving Charlie a message, which you're like, that's a terrible message. It's so abrupt, I had like missed it. I had to get you to rewind it. But, just repeat what this...
Yeah, whatever happened to the man who got everything he wanted? And the answer is he lived happily ever after. It's like, that's a fucked up message to leave kids with.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like there was, like, a middle part missing there.
Well, I guess it's like you're expecting... But it's typical Wonka, though, too.
Classic Wonka.
You're expecting him to give a moral, and he's like, nah, fuck it. What's wrong with rich people? It's like, nothing, they're rich, their lives are amazing. That's the answer.
So Charlie doesn't turn into Veruca Salt, I guess.
I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the Great Glass Elevator. Here's the thing. I think they were intending to... The reason why this ends so abruptly is... And the book does too, to be fair. It picks up right where it leaves off in the Great Glass Elevator. And they take the elevator and they go land at Charlie's house and pick up the rest of his family. And they go off in like wonky adventures.
Yeah, actually, from what I remember in the book, they kind of kidnap his grandparents. They're like, I think they land in the house and they're like, we're not going anywhere. And they like literally grab them and like throw them into the elevator.
And there's weird things where it's like they kind of travel through time in this.
Oh, wow.
And there's a weird thing where it's like actually they think they're traveling through time, but what they actually make, they make Grandpa Joe travel through time, so he becomes a six-year-old or something. There's just weird. It's just weird. It has nothing to do with the chocolate factory. It's them on wacky adventures, and that's the second book. And they did have a plan. Mel Stewart, the director or the writer, had an idea for what to do with its sequel, but they only got the rights to do this book when they were making it, and because Roald Dahl didn't like the adaptation, he wouldn't let them do Glass Elevator. So I think the idea was they left this one with such an abrupt ending because the plan was to do the second book as well.
Okay.
And they didn't do it because Roald Dahl wouldn't let them.
That would have been a pretty weird movie. It probably would have been pretty difficult for them to do.
I feel like I've tried to read it several times and I've never actually gotten through it. Because it just goes off. It feels like he was on something writing that book.
Yeah. What's your favorite Roald Dahl adaptation?
Oh, this one's a weird one because I just have such a long history with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tied to, like, my mother loved this movie, so I, you know, any of its weaknesses, I you know, instantly probably forgive.
Yeah, I don't think it has, I wouldn't say it has very many weaknesses. I think it kind of accomplishes what it sets out to do. I mean, the first half is really funny, the second half is really crazy and visually appealing, and
yeah,
I'd say
it's charming throughout.
Yeah.
I think I'm probably in the minority here, but I dug the BFG.
I thought I didn't see that one.
It's a weird book too, yeah. And Spielberg makes a weird movie with it.
Yeah,
it kind of fits, and I like some of the stuff he do. That was always my favorite book was BFG.
Yeah,
I love that book, and so I think I was terrified going into it, and I was shocked that it was fine.
Yeah,
it didn't. I didn't necessarily love it, but I didn't hate it. The Witches is. I'm trying to remember. The Witches is pretty good.
That's my number one. I love The Witches.
Yeah, I like The Witches quite a bit. I still haven't actually seen Matilda.
Oh, really? It's on Netflix.
But I love the book.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see a friend of mine, Paul Brancati, was in the musical when they did it here in Toronto. Mm-hmm. But I never got around to checking out the show. But there's a song in it that I absolutely love, yeah. The One I Grow Up.
Is that in the movie as well?
Yeah, The One I Grow Up.
I've seen the movie only once. It's good, though. Danny DeVito directed it, and...
Rhea Perlman plays the mom.
Yeah, you should do an episode on it.
I love that book growing up.
Yeah.
I remember reading that book in class, and we had to, like, act out a scene. Mm-hmm. And so I played the dad in the scene where he, like, fills the car full of sawdust and stuff.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember that. Again, I've only seen it once. I don't remember that one too well. I just remember that it was good. I know a lot of people, like, really love it.
I wonder if my favorite actually isn't Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Oh, yeah. I know. I'm always forgetting that one as well. That's great. I love that one.
That's a really good adaptation.
Yeah.
Especially because the book works really well, and they kind of veer in different paths at some point. But they work really, really well on their own. And again, it's like I think whenever they go really, like, Roald Dahl has such a dry wit about him that when he's paired with the right filmmaker... Mm-hmm. Like, that's Wes Anderson's thing. His thing is very dry.
Yeah.
And so it works really, really well.
Yeah, and all the stuff they added to it felt, like, really true to the material. Like,
Like, the off-the-cuff stuff felt like it's, like... Yeah, it felt like it was nice that, it let Wes Anderson put his own stamp on it. Mm-hmm. But it didn't feel like it was ridiculously off-point from Roald Dahl.
Yeah. But generally, though, it's pretty cool, like, eclectic mix of adaptations that are all kind of good in their own ways. When you put them back to back,
there's not really one that I go, oh, that's terrible. Like, even James and the Giant Peach.
Oh, yeah, that's great, too. Yeah, no, I love that one. I love stop motion, so I'm biased. But
yeah, the Twits has never been done.
No. What's the George's Marvelous Medicine or something like that? That's another popular one. It's never been done. Never been adapted, but no, it's a popular book.
There's one that I didn't realize had been adapted that Dustin Hoffman did. It's a weird one. It's a turtle. It's a tortoise thing.
Oh.
I'm going to look it up real quick because I didn't see it, but I read it. Was like one of the books that I read with my kids, and I was like, oh, this would be... But it's not very long either, so I was kind of shocked that they were able to adapt it in any way.
You know, they're making another Witches as well, Robert Zemeckis.
Yep, Zemeckis. I knew that.
Yeah, Anne Hathaway, I think, is in it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think she plays the head witch, right?
Yeah.
I'm all on board.
I'll see it, but I doubt it'll be as good as the other one. I just recently picked up the Blu-ray of the Nicholas Roeg one, and I think it holds up pretty well. Jim Henson, I think, did some of the effects on it as well, or contributed.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. It's like it's a weird story about this older man who lives like a floor above this other woman, and he tries to convince her that her tortoise is growing or shrinking or something.
Weird.
It's never. Bonkers. Anyway, I can't find it in here. I always forget that he wrote a Bond movie.
Who did? Roald Dahl?
Yeah.
Which one?
Oh, which is it?
No, I gotta find the screenplay? It. I had no idea.
Yeah, he wrote the screenplay for Tom and Jerry, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, upcoming. This is so weird. Yeah, he wrote the screenplay for, I'll have to look at it. Oh, that's what it's called. SEO Trot is the name of the turtle one. And it stars Dustin Hoffman and Judi Dench.
What year was that?
2015. It was fairly recent.
Oh, wow.
But it was a TV movie.
Oh.
Yeah, it's all kids. It's kids. Well, he wrote a couple adult novels too, right?
Yeah, and I heard they were pretty racist from what I heard. Or maybe that was just his personal views. But, again, of the time, I don't know.
Of the time. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, of the time for sure. There is some stuff in the... It's not necessarily... It doesn't come off as, like, racist, but that kind of stuff is not surprising.
Yeah.
You Only Live Twice is the Bond film he wrote.
Oh, I like that one, actually.
And he wrote the screenplay for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang as well.
Isn't the You Only Live Twice where James Bond goes undercover as an Asian man for part of it?
Yeah. So there you go, racism. I think that's one of those ones. I did all the Bond movies as my own separate podcast. I can't remember. They kind of blended together.
I would imagine
at one point. Well, the Connery ones, I'm going to, you know, they don't necessarily hold up all that well. They're pretty misogynistic and you know, rapey in some sections.
Yeah. Yeah, he punches pussy galore pretty hard.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole lot of not giving a shit about women in those movies that doesn't quite hold up.
No.
But also, like, do you forgive that? It's just it's a weird thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's cultural stamp. I mean, it's kind of good to go back and to see how, you know, casual people used to be about those things. I think it kind of marks a bit of a progression.
Oh, for sure.
You know, it's like that, you know, I don't want people to, like, you know, destroy those movies or not watch them because of that. You know, I think they've got their own merit.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. But even I was showing my son the, we were talking about, he's starting to plan his birthday party that's upcoming. And I was like, oh, we should, and he wants to have some friends over and do a big movie now. I'm like, oh, it'd be fun if I pick something classic for you that you can now watch, but you probably couldn't watch that long
ago.
Birth of a Nation. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. No, but I also wanted to watch something fun and funny. And I thought, I'm like, oh, you know what you haven't seen yet? Tropic Thunder.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, I bet you would love it.
Yeah.
And then I totally forgot about Robert Downey Jr.'s entire character doing blackface.
But people still seem to think that, like, they're fine with it.
Well, that joke was meant to be inappropriate back then. And they make fun of it enough. Like, there's that moment where he's like, "You people," and then the actual black guy's like, "What do you mean, you people?" So they're already acknowledging it's ridiculous.
Yeah, they.
But my son watched that trailer and he's like, "Oof, Iron Man, what were you doing?" It's like, this is pre Iron Man.
Right before Iron Man. But yeah, they knew going in. They all thought that would be the big controversy about that movie, but it was way more about Simple Jack and the whole speech. They got way more like flack over that. Then no one seemed to mind. Downey Jr. got an Oscar nomination for that movie.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
He actually got an Oscar nomination.
Yeah. Playing Kurt Lazarus, the guy who gets all the Oscar nominations. Yeah.
Good for doing.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's a good movie, though.
Great. And I always forget. And,
he'd make a good Willy Wonka. Downey Jr., he could do
He's pretty great. I haven't seen Doolittle. Apparently, it's not great.
I don't know what he was thinking. I think he's back on the smack again, taking that movie.
The one surprise, before we move off Topic Thunder, Tom Cruise in that movie is phenomenal. And it makes me want him to do more comedy.
Yeah, no, that's what I could think of when I was watching that, is like, why doesn't he do more of this? Like,
yeah, you don't need to just jump out of planes to entertain us and almost kill yourself.
Yeah.
You can do that, too.
He literally wants to die, like, making a Mission Impossible movie, it seems.
Yeah, he's bad. He's gonna. Yeah. We're gonna get 20 of those movies until he finally dies on set.
Yeah, I'm sure it's you've probably heard the stories about basically why he only does like safe action movies now. He'll never do like another Magnolia, and it's basically because of that whole press run he did after Mission Impossible 3, and went like crazy on Oprah, and like started talking about his personal life and everything like that, and then he's kind of like star status dropped a little bit, and then he's kind of like, okay, now we can only do like Tom Cruise action pictures, and he hasn't really done like a risky role in a long time. Think about it, in like 99, he's in like Eyes Wide Shut.
I think the closest thing he did, he was testing out like solid directors for a while.
Yeah.
I think the closest thing he's done that's off brand was Last Samurai.
Really? I mean, him being the...
That was a long time. That was around that period, though, too, wasn't it?
But yeah, and that's him being literally the Last Samurai. He's like...
But at least it was like more of an art film.
Yeah, yeah.
Than like when you're looking at the pure action...
Yeah, action or side.
Yeah, well, now he's doing, you know, he's going back as Maverick. Yeah. He's doing all these other...
Yeah, it also kind of feels like a little bit of a midlife crisis thing, too, where he's like, no, I'm still the action guy. Yeah, I can do anything, yeah.
And yeah, I'm still 20 years old. Yeah. Well, I think part of it's that.
Yeah.
And he's probably realizing he's only going to be able to do this stuff for so long before his body gives out on him. Yeah. I still think, I mean, I think there's a whole other chapter of Tom Cruise movies we're going to get in 20 years.
Hopefully. So. Yeah.
As long as he hasn't killed himself making Mission Impossible movies.
Yeah. Or dedicate himself to the church full time.
Yeah. Well, I think that pill has been swallowed.
Yeah.
He can make a Willy Wonka. And one of my favorites of his, too. That I finally found on Blu-ray is Vampire.
Interview with the Vampire.
Interview with the Vampire.
Yeah, he's good in that. I watched that like a year or two ago. It holds up pretty well.
Oh, good, because I haven't revisited it. That was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid.
It's good.
Yeah. And I was kind of worried about it. I'm probably going to do an episode on the podcast. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad to hear that it holds up.
Well, yeah, nothing enough. Stood out to me as like, oh, I don't remember that, or that hasn't aged well from what I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, I loved his character. I watched that, and then I went back and I got the books and I read all the, because he's Lestat is more of the main character in all the books.
Well, in the Vampire Lestat, the book called Vampire Lestat, yeah, right? He's got his own, and he becomes a rock star, doesn't he?
He is a rock. Yeah, well, because the Vampire Lestat is both a prequel and sequel.
Okay,
yeah. But then most of the other books, like the Vampire Chronicle books.
Yeah.
Lestat is kind of the mainstay. Like he's not always the hero or the lead character,
right?
But he's like the linchpin that kind of connects the entire universe,
right? Okay, yeah. I only read actually the Vampire Lestat is the only one I read, and it was a long time ago.
I liked it. I never saw the adaptation because it wasn't Tom Cruise. There's something about I love
Damned that one.
No, there's Queen of the Damned, but there was. Oh, didn't they do a Vampire Lestat movie, or were they going to?
I think maybe they're going to. And Lestat is in Queen of the Damned, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he's in all of them. He is like, whether it's a big or small part, he is the linchpin of that kind of shared universe.
He's the Iron Man of that universe.
He's the Iron Man of the Vampire Chronicles.
But yeah, earlier today, though, I was thinking like, oh, who would, if they did it again, who would they cast as Willy Wonka? And for some reason, the only name that came to mind, and I don't know if it's good or bad, it was like Rami Malek. I was like, I feel like they would want him in it. And I don't know if that would be terrible or really good.
He'd be great. He's very interesting. I think you'd also have to, though, now you'd have to either really switch it up and either you make it female or you go with someone who's just like such a different kind of choice.
Yeah.
Like someone like
Jesse Eisenberg.
Eisenberg. Oh, but even like someone like Kevin Hart or someone like, because Kevin Hart could do the dry bit. Although it'd be too much Kevin Hart, like, you'd want someone that isn't just playing like a slight version of themselves, which is kind of what Kevin Hart does.
Yeah,
I don't know. You'd want to do something really different with it because you've got like Johnny Depp doing like the Michael Jackson thing, and you got Gene Wilder doing just like a really dry. Like for Gene Wilder, really, when you look at the rest of his filmography, it's kind of a subdued performance.
Yeah, well, I was thinking this today too. I think the only other movie that I'm really familiar with Gene Wilder in is Hear No Evil, See No Evil.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, it was a staple growing up in my house. But
what do you mean I'm not white?
Yeah,
great.
But because I am deaf, anyways. But yeah, I know I can name a few other movies of his, but I couldn't say that I've like seen them or I'm super familiar with him as an actor generally. But yeah, he's good.
Well, you must have, did you watch any Mel Brooks movies?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. Young Frankenstein, scene and, The Producers I saw like later in life. What else was he in of Mel Brooks?
I want to say he was in Blazing Saddles. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course.
He's the mayor. Blazing
Saddles. Yeah, yeah.
Not the mayor. He's the sheriff.
Yeah. I haven't watched that in a really long time. That'd be a good one to do on the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. Those are all great. Yeah, we haven't done a Mel Brooks movie yet.
Yeah.
We should go. Blazing Saddles is the one to do.
Mel Brooks, well, especially because there's so many things you could dissect in that movie now.
Yeah, there's some stuff that, well, there's that, I remember, that's one of those movies I saw as a kid because my dad loved it. And that, the campfire scene, like, made my dad laugh like a child.
Yeah.
Like, just utter glee of watching my dad laugh at, like, the biggest fart joke ever.
Mongo, right? They're all waiting for Mongo.
Yeah.
He's the,
The sheriff is near gag, which is I think that still plays because again the movie's self-aware.
Yeah,
that the characters in the movie are racist. The movie's not necessarily racist.
Yeah, I think it. That's why I'm curious to revisit it. And because it is. Yeah, like you said, it's self-aware. It's commenting like the characters are supposed to be racist, but I'm sure there's obvious. Like I don't think they would make it today, but I don't think that it should be made or needs to be made. I don't think that means that that the original is bad or anything. I'm sure it's still great. But speaking of Mel Brooks, some of those interstitials and jokes in the first half made me think of Mel Brooks, like when he puts the microphone to Augustus's dad's mouth.
He just bites it.
He just bites it. That felt like a Mel Brooks gag to me a little bit.
Yeah, or like the Muppets or something. Like it's very like there's something in there that just feels like this guy's a cartoon character.
Yeah.
Which they kind of are to some extent.
Yeah. It's a weird, like, I don't know, what else I could compare it to. Like, it's like Woody Allen meets Mel Brooks or something for a lot of those bits.
Yeah, it's very of the era. It's funny, because, the movie has, I mean, kind of a grounded, but no, it's a heightened tone. It's not really grounded in our world. Like, it's a bit over the top.
Yeah.
So here's a question I have for you,
mm-hmm.
as we get close to wrapping this up. Did Willy Wonka somehow handpick Charlie from the very beginning?
Well, that Slugsworth seemed to know where all the winners were going to be.
Right?
So, that would be a case for that, for sure.
Yeah, he shows up awfully conveniently.
Yeah, he knows where all the tickets are, it seems. So, but how would he have handpicked him? Like, how, do you think he's got, spies out in the world trying to find kids in need? Or?
Well, you've also got, Charlie... It's the shop owner that hands over that bar and is like, why don't you take one of these regular ones?
Oh, yeah.
So you could argue that Slugsworth was in there.
Yeah.
And Slugsworth's the one that dropped the coin conveniently on the way past the, they set up enough pieces in place.
Yeah. Yeah.
That
yeah,
all these
you make
things,
that argument. Yeah. It didn't occur to me, but that... But then why go through all of that then? Because he picks the worst kids possible for the rest of them. It's like they didn't stand a chance. Why wouldn't he pick five virtuous kids?
Yeah, why wouldn't you pick five great kids and see? But it's almost like he had picked this kid and just wanted to make sure he would do the right thing. Yeah. But there's also what's great about it, and kind of for me almost validates the fizzy lifting drink scene, is that it's like, he'd written Charlie off there.
Mm-hmm.
He legitimately has written Charlie off there. But when he returns the Gobstopper, that's the thing that brings him back. Like, the test was kind of over. He had actually written him off. Like, he didn't die from it.
Yeah.
Because they learned how to burp.
Yeah.
But that could have ended badly.
Yeah. Well, they were kind of just holding themselves on the top of the roof, though. I felt like they could have just,
They could have coasted for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that there's some value to it in the sense that, but it is an off character moment for them.
Mm. Yeah, that Charlie has no second guesses. Just like, yeah, let's do this. But yeah, it is his grandfather. Kids are easily influenced. It's really the grandfather's fault.
It does make them human. It makes them a little bit flawed. But he does, he has that redeeming moment at the end where he's like, no, I'm not gonna.
So, I mean, I guess this would go towards your case. If it was Willy Wonka did want Charlie all along, then maybe Willy Wonka was legitimately angry in that scene because he's really disappointed in Charlie. Yeah.
Well, now he's got no one to leave it to. Well, he said this is a tremendous waste of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. And it's almost like everything is designed. Like, he picked these other kids to see how Charlie would react to them.
Right.
In a way.
Very non-judgmental. He barely interacts with them at all. He's just kind of like...
Yeah.
You do you, Augustus.
Yeah. He's like, sure. Please don't stop. Yeah, please.
Yeah. Again, you're right. It's like he knew what they were going to do all along. Like, yeah.
Yeah. But you're right. If you were really doing this, you'd go, why wouldn't you hedge your bets and pick five proper options rather than the other four of the shittiest kids on the planet?
Yeah.
Unless you're trying to teach the world a lesson, too. Because in theory, they all broke their contracts, and none of them are getting a lifetime supply of chocolate.
Yeah. Yeah.
One would assume.
Yeah. Although, I don't know if your signature is legally binding at that age. So.
Yeah, that's that contract itself. Yeah. There's a couple flaws inside the whole logic of that.
Yeah. And you could make arguments, too, that, the other kids did have some virtues, like, they didn't really illustrated as well in this one. But Mike TV is kind of supposed to be a genius in his own way. Like, he's figured out the algorithm, and then the chewing gum girl, I forget, but she's like, you know, like a super hard, like dedicated worker, I feel. And, you know, once she sets her mind to a goal, she's accomplishes it. But yeah, the other two, like Augustus and Veruca, they're just like spoiled. Like,
well, you could argue that Augustus has some kind of palate.
Yeah, it's true. He loves candy. Yeah. So he's got that going for him.
So as long as he's like discerning to some extent, true. You're good. But if he'll just eat anything, it's like, yeah, give him the slug's worth.
Yeah.
And then what would be her, Veruca is just a
She doesn't really have anything redeeming. Little,
no, there's nothing about, literally, she's the only one that is the shittiest human being possible.
Just a bad egg.
Yeah. I forgot that in the books it was also squirrels, and she wants a special squirrel.
And it was nuts. It's because they're sorting nuts. And actually I really like that scene in the Tim Burton one. The squirrels are really well done. Yeah, checking all the nuts.
And they knocking on her head.
Yeah, yeah.
It's checking, like, oh, nuts. It's not a bad one.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, I wonder why they switched that.
I think it's easier to do geese and eggs than squirrels and
oh,
nuts.
Yeah, you can't do CGI squirrels back then. Right. Yeah, yeah. There was no way to do the squirrels.
Yeah.
In the live-action movie in 1971.
And there was a funny joke where he's like, but it's past Easter. It's like, shut up. They don't know that.
We're trying to get ahead of next year.
Yeah.
Jesus. Well, there's moments that's again, what I love about, like, you know, it's in the writing as well, I assume. But it's like, you know, Wonka's very competent. Mm-hmm. I love all the moments when whenever he's asked questions and he finds ways out of answering them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was always saying to Mike TV, like, I think in both the Burton and the book, it's like, you really have to stop mumbling. I can't really hear you. And he does like a different
word you're saying.
Different version of it in this. But yeah, same idea. Yeah, those are always funny.
It's very funny. Any other final thoughts?
I think I had more than I realized. So
is this going to make you read Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator?
Probably. Well, no, you didn't really recommend it.
I want you to read it so I don't have to.
Okay.
I want you to read it and report back to me. That's not an assignment. You don't have to do this.
All right. I'll put it on the list. I think my brother has that same box set that you mentioned you had, so maybe I'll borrow it.
Should you read it?
Yeah.
Please let me know.
Report back.
Your thoughts. Okay. But, don't feel you have to. And any listeners out there, feel free to tweet at us your thoughts on Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, because I really don't think I could try reading it a third time. I have given it the old college try, and every time I think I abandoned it. I think it was my son this time. He's just like, I don't want to read this anymore.
Why are you doing this?
Yeah, they're not in the chocolate factory anymore. That was the whole hook before, and it's kind of gone.
Yeah, this is not the hill to die on.
No, they're just kind of like bouncing through time and space. It's a real weird existential thing from what I recall.
I mean, at the very least, there should be some good Roald Dahl jokes, I'd imagine.
Yeah, there's got to be some good stuff about being shitty to kids.
Yeah, because, I mean, the Roald Dahl stories, you're not really there for the plot most of the time. You're there kind of for the jokes and the little, like, situations he comes up with. It's not like, you know, it's a thrilling... We all know that Charlie's going to get the factory. Charlie's going to be the last kid standing. It's not like a nail-biter or a whodunit or anything.
So. No, it's the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah, the destination in most Roald Dahl books are not like... The endings aren't usually that great.
Yeah.
They're kind of just more inevitable.
Yeah.
Or they just sort of end.
Yeah.
Yeah, his books are definitely about the journey along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming over.
Oh, thanks for having me. That was great.
Yeah.
I love your setup.
Oh, thanks, bud. We'll do this again.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us for Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Black Hole Films is a proud member of the That Shelf Podcast Network. You can listen to other episodes of our show and other That Shelf podcasts on thatshelf.com. Please subscribe, leave comments, spread the word, do all the things that let others know you like the show and how they can check it out. You can find me on Twitter, @LonJeremy, and go to Facebook and join the group Black Hole Films. And until next time, go watch something you've never seen before. Thanks.
Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.